Dr. Paul, welcome to Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. This segment, I interview Dr. Zanga. He is a former president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Now, as you might wonder, we may not agree on everything, but I wanted you to hear from somebody as prominent as Dr. Zanga. Every opinion is important, and I think what's interesting is COVID's done something. I mean, even the most prominent mainstream doctors, some of them are going, something's not right here with COVID. So we discuss that. We discuss a history of pediatrics. It's going to be a fun interview just to kind of see what we can do with this. You're not going to want to miss it. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. My topic for today is love and compassion. What can we do when someone's hurting? I see homelessness all around Portland when I'm driving around. There seems to be suffering everywhere. There's refugees, we have war vets, people are medically injured. I'm in medicine, we're dealing with illness, injury. I had a major shoulder surgery where they took the tendon that was right here to come off 2 inches and got drilled into this bone with plastic anchors, and I'd never been in so much pain in my life. This was physical pain, and it's nothing compared to so many things that people endure, but for me, it was the worst pain of my life, and it lasted a few months. It seemed unbearable. I had a cat named Luna. Luna stayed with me day and night. I had to move from the bed to the couch, and I couldn't do much else. And it was so comforting just to feel that other being there with me. And I think as I always reflect back to that, I realize when someone is suffering, they need us to be there with them. If you can just be present, get physical contact if you can, appropriate physical contact, hold hands, just touch the person. It is so comforting. And people need love, people need comfort. So reach out when you see suffering, be compassionate. I think we're all called to this, and it's just such a beautiful world we live in when we can live in that way. Welcome, Dr. Joseph Zanga, to Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire.
Nice to be here. Thank you for allowing me to participate in this.
Thank you, Joe. I am going to let our audience know your background, because my goodness, you are a past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Folks, if you don't understand what that means, let me explain. So I've been a pediatrician for 35 years. I was board certified for 30 of those years. That is, just achieving board certification means you've gone through extensive training and you've reached a level of competency. We have to take tests. You were old enough that you were grandfathered in. You didn't have to keep taking those darn tests, but I missed that by a year. So every 10 years I would take the test. But anyway, you were the president, and the Academy of Pediatrics is a very prestigious organization representing pediatricians across the country. But you've held many other posts. You were the founding chair of the section on school health, chair of the section on bioethics, founding president of the American College of Pediatricians, retired chief of pediatrics at Columbus Regional Health in Georgia, chair and assistant dean in primary care at Brody School of Medicine, chair of pediatrics at Loyola, vice chair at Louisiana State, and professor in pediatrics and emergency medicine at LSU and Tulane. You've co-authored over 30 articles, 15 AAP publications, 20 book chapters. You're a reviewer of multiple pediatric journals, all the top journals, and you've had a lot of involvement with the board of the Medical Institute for Sexual Health. You've served on the National Advisory Council of the National Center for Primary Care at Morehouse Medical School and the National Council of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at NIH. So during your tenure, I know you've, because I read your bio, I mean, you focus on so many important issues, pre-professional education, the workforce, child abuse. I too did a lot of work in child abuse, violence prevention, substance abuse, access of healthcare for all children. You've always been a real promoter of family health, and for that being important for the well-being of kids. And then Yeah, you've been a board member for the directors for the Academy. Actually, you were elected to that position in 1989. I was just barely out of training. Wow. So welcome and thank you for bringing this expertise to us. I thought for fun, because you preceded me by a number of years, so you've got a background in pediatrics that's about, what, 50 years of being in the field?
Yes. And even though my career was academically based, medical schools and doing teaching, and that was a real big joy. But in retirement, the thing I have missed most is interacting with children, particularly the little ones. And one of the things that rings in my head all the time is that I would go into a room with a mama and a baby, and I would certainly talk to mother, but then I'd talk to the baby. I would talk baby talk. I think a lot of pediatricians do that.
Yep.
And the interns and residents and medical students would look at me strangely. What are you doing? You can't be talking to the baby. I said, of course I am. And we'd talk about this afterward, and I would go back in and we'd discuss things with the family. And I would tell them, I'm going to go talk to the baby after I finish talking to mother. Watch how the baby responds. And by this time, I'd become a little familiar to the baby, and he or she would talk back to me in baby talk. And as you know, that's the way babies develop speech and language. They start out with sounds, and we can help them learn those sounds by talking to them in plain English or Spanish or French or whatever, but also talking to them in baby talk sounds.
Yeah. Oh, I'm just smiling because that's exactly what I do. And I'm sure you had this same process when you've got a sick child who might be very ill. That ability to connect, I mean, that's an art and a skill as a pediatrician. Then you kind of can assess, you know, are they really okay? Or is this a kid who might have meningitis and be in real trouble, for example?
Pediatrics and the interaction of with the doctor, with the child and the family is what made it a joyful kind of career experience. I tell people, because I taught in a family medicine program for a time, pediatricians are the original family physicians, because we cared for children in the context of their families and provided a lot of advice to the adults in the household as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. So just for fun, because I get to talk to somebody of your stature and wealth of knowledge and depth of experience. I grew up in Africa. My parents were missionaries. I left Africa when I was 18, went to college, Dartmouth, and then on to being a pediatrician. But when I started in pediatrics, well, first of all, going back to Africa growing up, mostly what we were dealing with in pediatrics felt like it was infectious diseases. We weren't seeing chronic conditions like we do today. I was wondering if you could share with what your experience has been in sort of the change in what pediatrics used to deal with when you first started to what's now happening.
Yeah, Paul, yes. And my experience different than yours. I grew up in New York City. I've lived my whole career really in the South, with the exception of Chicago for a time. And I say that I'm from the South. Now, that's the South Bronx, of course, but it's it rings true to some people. Pediatrics. When I started, we were still giving smallpox inoculations. That stopped because we had eradicated smallpox.
Smallpox preceded me. I never gave that one. Is it true that one sometimes had some rough side effects?
It did, but fortunately, I never saw them. The children that I vaccinated seemed to do quite well. And for that, I'm grateful. We also spent a lot of time talking to families about the vaccines we were given and then the number of vaccines as they increased and the complexity of the vaccination schedule. So yes, in those days, we were still very much concerned about infectious diseases. We transitioned to behavioral and emotional problems of children. And I can remember one of our physicians, a physician who was first a mentor of mine, and then a colleague of mine at the Medical College of Virginia, a pediatric neurologist who was very, very interested in something called ADD, attention deficit disorder. And some of the medications that we use, which were strange, but you know, sometimes they worked. And then ADD became ADHD. And even that over time into the late 90s, early 2000s, evolved into a much more complex thing than we were first imagining it to be. For example, one of the things that was discussed by a sleep medicine physician, pediatrician, was, you know, be careful of this diagnosis. If a child isn't sleeping, well, when they get to school, what might happen? Well, they might fall asleep. Well, then they're attention deficit disorder.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or in order to stay awake, they would jostle the kid next to them or get up and walk around the room. And then they were attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. When their real problem was that they were sleep deprived. And so you need to ask those kinds of questions.
Absolutely.
And then we got into other things as well. Drug, alcohol use and abuse, smoking, and lately now vaping. All of these things were new to pediatricians. And our tendency was to refer these people, children, and their families to mental health professionals, psychiatrists, pediatric psychiatrists. And pretty soon, they were so overwhelmed because of the paucity of pediatric mental health professionals and the fact that we were referring so many patients to them, that they wanted us to do that kind of care. And so we were providing a lot of advice, counseling to children and their families on a whole host of diseases, conditions. Yeah. So, you know, that's how things changed. Telemedicine was a more recent advance, perhaps an advance. It seems like it works. I think that's, I mean, we could go on for an hour about the changes in pediatrics, There are other things to talk about today.
No, absolutely. And I want to reassure our viewers. I wanted to get a little history there. I experienced what you experienced with regards to chronic disease, the ADD, ADHD, autism. You know, it was so rare when I started my career back in the 80s. And by the 2000s, it was so common that all the subspecialists were overwhelmed and we were actually managing. I mean, at one point in my career, I had over 15,000 patients, active patients in my practice. Obviously, I had helpers. It wasn't me alone. And we had 1,000 with ADD, ADHD out of those 15,000. It's like, wow, there weren't enough pediatric subspecialists to do that. And I'm just one practice out of many. I'm concerned, and then I'll be interested in your take on this, that they introduced a new technology, this mRNA platform. They tried to do this before back with MERS and SARS, and they were unsuccessful at having this platform be safe. I mean, when they did full testing, it was disastrous. And yet, you know, at warp speed, we rolled out a brand new, well, not that new, but a technology with potential danger and sort of just went full steam ahead without safety studies. Studies that they did, to me, seem to have been very poorly designed. The control group was allowed to vaccinate. So essentially, they've erased the control group. Pfizer did that. I think Moderna probably did as well. And now we have reports of so much harm, and yet the CDC still is promoting it. Now, you come from a background where, you know, vaccines saved the world. I mean, you're all in. But what's going on now with COVID?
More than most of the general public knows, or perhaps more than the general public wants to know. Generally speaking, it takes years to bring a vaccine from thought to market. I think the fastest one in my memory was mumps, and that was 6 or 7 years from start to actual beginning of use. This came very fast, this COVID biological. The American Academy of Pediatrics, and I was there, I was a supporter. We fought a battle over the pertussis vaccine. A friend, colleague of mine, was sued for, $2 million because a child who got the whole cell pertussis vaccine developed intractable seizures. What were our alternatives? Well, in, I believe, Japan, maybe a couple of other countries, they were using an acellular pertussis vaccine. And the question that some of us raised was, we proved, a lot of very good studies proved that the pertussis vaccine in and of itself, the whole cell vaccine, did not cause intractable seizures. A febrile seizure now and then, but not this chronic problem. And yet we still decided we were going to go with the acellular vaccine. Some of us expressed concern that it might not be long-lived. Turns out it wasn't. Within probably 10 years of the start of using it, we were seeing an increase in the number of pertussis cases. And we finally decided we had to give boosters, and then more boosters, and then more boosters. We also helped, instrumental in, gave our stamp of approval to the adverse events reporting system. COVID was developed very quickly, COVID in biological. The companies reported the success of the vaccine, but in relative terms, not absolute terms. And that's an important distinction, which sometimes is hard for me to understand, but the scientists with whom I deal say it's a critically important thing. And when you talk about absolute protection, the vaccines fail miserably.
Yeah. Pfizer, they all over the news, 95% protection. That was a relative risk reduction. But if you looked at absolute risk reduction, it was less than 1%.
Right.
Now, would you line up for a vaccine that hasn't been tested properly, that might have unknown dangers, for a less than 1% risk reduction? And by the way, they were just testing, I think it was reduction of symptoms. They weren't even testing eliminating hospitalizations or deaths.
No, but this reporting system is, first of all, it's a flawed system. It requires pages of information, and a lot of physicians are reluctant to spend the time making these reports. Yet there are thousands of reports of adverse effects, at least temporarily related to getting the biological.
Yeah, over a million now, and I think deaths are over 30,000. It's incredible.
And the CDC has very recently said, even under the Freedom of Information Act, they will not release even redacted versions of the autopsy reports on the deaths which are being attributed in the reporting system to the COVID biological. Then there are some other things too that worried me and others from the start. How do we know somebody has COVID? Well, there are certainly symptoms. And in September of 2020, I lost my sense of smell. I had low-grade fever, shaking, chills. I was a very sick puppy for a day or two. And I finally got in touch with my doctor. And I said, doctor, can I, I think I may have COVID. What should I do? Come in, we'll test you. With all those symptoms, I tested negative. I've tested negative about, six times. Now, this past summer, I was on vacation on a cruise, and I felt a little bit achy, a little bit feverish. So I tested myself one of those home kits. I tested positive. So I went to the ship's doctor and I said, I'm sick. I may have COVID. And the doctor said, well, let's test you. And he took out a similar test kit and said, you're negative. Now, was I a false negative or was I a false positive? And then I go back to what my doctor did. She did PCR testing. Now, that's polymerase chain reaction, as you know. It's a cyclical thing. You run many cycles, and if it turns positive after X number of cycles, you have the disease. Well, the recommendation internationally was 28 cycles. If you didn't test positive after 28 cycles, or by 28 cycles, you were negative. What do we do in this country? We tested through 40 cycles.
35 to 40.
All right. And at that cycle number, you were testing positive for dead virus, no virus, some other virus. So all of these millions of cases of COVID and all these deaths from COVID were people who tested positive, not that they had the disease.
Correct.
And so many of these admissions and deaths were not deaths from COVID or admissions from COVID. They were admissions and deaths with COVID. CDC finally admitted this a year or so ago, and yet they still kept counting as if a positive PCR at 40 cycles proved that you had the disease. So, all of this was strange. And then people had the opinion that two doses of the Pfizer or Moderna or a dose of the J&J would not provide long-term protection. Oh, yes, it would, said the pundits, those people who are following the science. And as it turns out, it didn't. They needed a booster. And then another booster. And now we may need another booster because the Omicron variant may not be effectively the old vaccines may not be effectively protective against the Omicron variant or the next variant or the next variant. And people who, most of the people I know today, you know, October the 6th of 2022, who in the last month or two have been tested positive for COVID, have had the vaccine and the boosters. Mr. Biden and his wife have tested positive, though they've had the vaccines and the boosters. And then after being treated, tested positive again. Is this a good biological or not? And now I come to the question of, we're going to immunize children with this biological. And you have to ask the question, how badly affected, infected, diseased have children been through this whole pandemic, if that's what it is? And the answer is very few. And if they've tested positive, they've tested positive with PCR. So we know that that's not necessarily the right thing. But the younger they are, the less they test positive, the fewer symptoms they have, the less sick they get, the fewer are hospitalized, the less care is needed in the hospital. Why are we so insistent that they get this vaccine? Biological. I haven't got the answer to that question, and I don't know if anybody does. And yet, we are insisting that that happens. And follow the science. Well, I have two sisters. Neither of them are medical people. My sister in New York got COVID, tested positive. Her husband tested positive. He got sick enough to be hospitalized for 24 hours. Got treated, remdesivir, went home, did fine. When the boosters arrived, my sister went to her doctor and said, had COVID. I got the vaccine, both doses. Do I need to get a booster? And he said, well, considering that you had the disease, you got the vaccine, no, you don't need the booster. Her husband has the same doctor. He goes in a week or two later and says, had the disease. I got sick enough with it. I had to be hospitalized, treated. I got the vaccine, two doses. Do I need the booster? And he said, why, of course you need the booster. So he said, well, I'll think about this. He went home and he and his wife, and so she calls me and says, Joe, do I need a booster? And she gave me this story. I said, you know, it depends on which scientists you read, on which day, in which journal, and has it been vetted or pre-printed? And so the answer to that question is, my firm belief is you do not need a booster, nor does John, your husband, need a booster.
And how about their kids and grandkids? So we're pediatricians. We have had a long career, yours longer than mine. We're supposed to represent, we're supposed to stand in the gap for kids. They can't speak for themselves. They're being targeted, it appears to me, by a powerful industry that's making billions of dollars. What can we do? What would you say?
What I say is, this is what I know, and I give the abbreviated version of what I just told you, and you have to make the decision. These are your children or your child. I have recommended to the parents of my grandchildren, to the parents of my sister's children, that the vaccine is probably not necessary. And that's the, you know, that's the best, most honest answer I can give. If these were, if my children were still toddlers or young children, I would not be giving them this vaccine.
So Dr. Zanga, help me understand, you know, as a former president of the Academy of Pediatrics, how is it that the AAP, the CDC, the public health officials in almost every state are really, it seems, pushing this COVID jab, this biologic, on the population, including kids? And you and I, as pediatricians who really have looked at a lot of research, it doesn't make sense. What do you think's going on?
I don't know. And I wish I did. I've asked this question a number of times, and I really don't get an answer. Sometimes it feels like we pediatricians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the AMA, AAFP, the family practice physicians, are all fearful of bucking the establishment. And that worries me, because it's our responsibility to buck the establishment when we think that things are not being, that the science isn't there. One of the things that people have commented on is, what about natural immunity? My suspicion is that, especially for pediatricians who've been exposed for years and years to the three common upper respiratory URI cold viruses, one of which is coronavirus, we probably have some natural immunity to this new novel coronavirus. My suspicion is that other people who've had frequent upper respiratory infections probably have some natural immunity. We're not testing for that. Don't know why not. There are other things that trouble me. When I was on the National Advisory Council for the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at the NIH, we were approving grants for a number of different things. And in the millions of dollars, sometimes to people in other countries, researchers in other countries. And the question I asked was, if they develop this thing, whatever it happened to be, and it was being used then by the population, sold, do we get the money from that? Does the U.S. Treasury, does NIH get their money back? And the answer was, well, no, of course not. And I asked, why not? And there was no answer to that question. So you're right in what you said before. Pfizer, Moderna, to some lesser extent, J&J, Johnson & Johnson, are making multi-millions of dollars from these biologicals. Maybe billions.
Billions. Pfizer's increase was $30 billion. They're up from 30 to
just 70. From the just, just from from the COVID. All right. Yep.
You remember the days like when hepatitis B was rolled out and it got added to the childhood schedule? I think it was 1 to 2 billion that was a cha-ching for the manufacturer. So if a pharmaceutical company can get a vaccine on the childhood schedule, that's at least a billion. Well, this is a whole new thing because it's the entire world we're rolling this out to. Everybody has to get it. They've got to get boosters. It's insane amount of money.
Well, and we, the U.S. government, you and I, the taxpayers, paid to develop this.
And paid to buy these to distribute for free.
Yes. And you know, it boggles the mind. We're not business people. Pediatricians are certainly not business people, but it turns out the federal government isn't business people either. So, you know, it's a puzzle. This whole thing is a puzzle. And I don't have an answer. I just know that because I had already paid for a vacation and I couldn't get my money back, I had to get a vaccine. So I chose the J&J, one shot, and I was done. I survived, but I'm not getting any boosters. And, you know, I've passed on a couple of vacations because they have said, oh, and to come to our hotel or get on our cruise ship or get on our airplane, you need to have not only the vaccine, but a booster. And I was, you know, no, not going to do it.
So you're a living example of coercion, right? The lack of informed consent. This has been something I've been fighting for most of my career. I don't have a problem with anybody choosing to do whatever they want to do for themselves. I have a bigger problem, though, when it's involving children. And I know there's real danger. And you're targeting, you know, voiceless, helpless people with incredible marketing and massive budgets to manipulate. But what about our peers? How can we wake them up?
I don't know. I wish I did. I have spoken to community groups about this, and I get some say, you're right. And I get others who pull their mask up tighter and say that I'm crazy, I'm wrong. And that, you know, I'm going to die and I'm going to kill other people. If you tell a lie often enough, it becomes the truth. And people believe it. And if you and I and our pediatric colleagues are surrounded every day, all day, with somewhat conflicting, but generally in the direction of, this is a deadly disease. It's killing millions of people around the world. We must put on masks. We must isolate. We must close the schools and the churches and everything else in order to protect everybody. And now we have vaccines and boosters, and we all were obligated to get them. If this is what you hear all the time, and you hear it from not only the media, but from your professional organizations, pretty soon you believe it. Or even if you don't believe it, you don't want to lose your license. You don't want to be ostracized by your peers. You don't want to be dismissed from the hospital. If you're in the military, medical or not, you don't want to be dismissed from your job, from the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, whatever. Interesting article recently. Mr. Biden sent a called, letter of congratulations, whatever, to a Coast Guard corpsman who was rescuing people in Florida from the hurricane. Visuals of him hoisting people up into the helicopter, holding on to them for dear life, their lives. He's being dismissed from the Coast Guard because for religious reasons, he won't take the vaccine. Now, how can you be a hero to the president and anathema to the military organization to which you just performed heroic service? Craziness.
Yeah, it's absolute craziness. And I feel like I became vaccine risk aware, like I said, back at the hepatitis B level. That vaccine has 250 micrograms of aluminum. Little newborns, they're per weight kilo amount of aluminum. It just didn't make sense toxicology wise. And hepatitis B was just such a low risk for that age group. I understand your explanation earlier. That's the standard sort of explanation. But when you fast forward to COVID, my goodness, the wool has to come off your eyes, folks. Our peers, we've got to find a way to reach people. And I know exactly what you said is so true. People are fearful for their jobs. I've spoken to so many pediatricians who have now taken a stand and they've lost their jobs. You know, it's happening. The pressure, I mean, that law in California where doctors can't even talk about COVID in anything other than the approved government wording. I mean, this is just turning doctors into robots. You can't even have a doctor-patient relationship. They're ruining it. They're going to destroy medicine if we don't take a stand.
Well, we're not just destroying medicine, but we're setting an example for how we can indoctrinate people to do what the leaders say we need to do. 1984 and Brave New World. Authors who were prescient about this kind of thing. I recently came across a speech that Khrushchev gave at the United Nations about how the Soviet Union was going to bury us, not with arms, but with ideas, make us subservient to beliefs that we're going to be indoctrinated with. There are many examples in certainly my parents' and your parents' lifetimes of nations where that is exactly what happened. And yeah, I'm not just fearful for our profession. I am fearful for us as a society. But it starts somewhere, and it's really starting with us. We used to be able to sit and discuss things. We'd argue, sometimes pounding on the desk arguments. And then we go out and have lunch together and chat about our kids and going fishing or whatever. We don't do that anymore. You know, if you don't believe what I'm telling you to believe, you're my enemy. And I won't associate with you. I have great difficulty with that. I'm fearful about that.
Yeah.
So it's beyond just COVID. I'm waiting for monkeypox to be, you know, the next thing that we have to vaccinate the world for. I'm worried.
Yeah. I'm suspicious that the monkeypox thing's just going to fade away. I don't think people are buying it. they're going to have to
There is one article that has been published that says it is fading. I haven't seen a sequel to that article. So,
yeah,
but no, I think you're right.
I don't think they're going to be able to sell that one, but I am not putting it past them. There will be another pandemic And because it's so effective, my goodness, you can put it baffles my mind that governors all of a sudden have more power than the president of the United States, because they can declare a state of emergency and they can institute quarantines and shut down your businesses. I mean, they're public health and governors. Put those two agencies together. Add to that the medical boards that are controlling the physicians, and they've got total control. That's a scary situation. And the emergencies, they never turn them off, right? You declare an emergency as they did back in, what was it, March of 2020 for COVID, and they haven't let up.
They've only let up a little bit. Fortunately, the children are back in school. My grandchildren are all school age, and it's very clear. And they say it. They've lost a year. And they'll never get it back. I'm sure out where you live, and certainly where I live, there's not a business that doesn't have a sign out saying help wanted and offering actually mega employment bonuses. And yet people aren't taking the jobs. What are they doing? Unemployment is down because people aren't even looking for jobs anymore. They don't register.
Yeah.
And all this was generated by a virus, which likely was not as bad as we were all led to believe.
Yeah, that's for sure. I have a busy practice. Several providers, not a single child hospitalized the entire pandemic, except for one who went and got the COVID jab and got myocarditis.
Yes.
So yes. It's just a non-issue for most kids. And thank you for your, with your length of a career, and would it be safe to say you're a very pro-vaccine doctor? I mean, that's been your legacy with being the president of the AAP. And even you have said for this COVID thing, enough's enough.
Well, it's not just the AAP, the American College of Pediatricians. We are pro-vaccine in general. We have some concerns. And what we want is something you brought up earlier. We want informed consent.
Yeah.
We want people to know when we're saying to them, your children need these vaccines, why? And I can make a case for most of the vaccines. I have difficulty with the HPV vaccine, and I have difficulty with the COVID vaccine for all the reasons that we've talked about.
Yep. Those are the two that I have the most difficulty with. Then comes hepatitis B for newborns. I mean, if you're a teenager and you're out there being sexually active or you're sharing dirty needles, yeah, you better get it, buddy. But I know my newborns in my practice aren't having sex or sharing needles, and they're being loved by their parents. And the other problem I have with the full vaccine schedule, and you can choose to address this or not, is just that the whole schedule was never tested for safety. We don't have a vaxxed, unvaxxed, really good study, certainly nothing prospective. And I know they say it's unethical to do, but think about it. Every time you introduce a new vaccine, like when they had introduced this COVID vaccine, nobody had been vaccinated. So you obviously had a huge group of unvaccinated, un-COVID vaxxed people. We just had to compare, but they never do that.
They never do that. And now we're into the flu season, where we have a lot of children getting sick with the flu, hospitalized. And now we're saying to parents, the media is saying to parents, the CDC is saying to parents, Pfizer and Moderna are saying to parents, you know, now's a perfect time for you to get your flu vaccine and either your COVID vaccine or your COVID vaccine booster.
Yeah.
And you're right. There's not a single study that says if you mix these two vaccines, one in one arm and one in the other, know, the body is a miraculous thing. You can swallow a handful of different pills for all the conditions that you have, and the body knows where to send each one of those medicines to. Is it going to do the same thing when it gets the flu vaccine and the COVID biologic at the same time? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we know the COVID by itself is a problem, so I can't imagine adding other things on top of that's going to be good.
It is unlikely to be good. And maybe the worst fear, if it's, you know, what's good and what's not good, is will it inhibit the protectiveness of both of those vaccines? I mean, flu vaccine is never more than about, it's always less than 50% protective.
Yeah.
And we know that the COVID vaccine is probably considerably less than that if you look at absolute protection.
Right.
Are we going to now walk around and say, I'm protected from both COVID and the flu?
The experience I've had, and I've actually published some data, vaxxed, unvaxxed, the less vaccinated you are, actually the less sick you get. And think of what's happened with this COVID situation. We know that to be true. Kids who have a lot of innate natural immunity have done wonderful with COVID. But you start vaccinating people, yeah, you get an antibody response that lasts for a few months, maybe even up to 7 months, but then you go into the negative and you're actually worse off than you were before. And that's just antibodies. You're also hindering their natural immunity with these with these jabs.
Yeah. My only grandson, the rest of my grandchildren are girls, my only grandson, about 2 weeks after he got his, because his father wouldn't listen to me, got his COVID booster, he developed myocarditis.
Mm.
Yeah, he recovered.
Right.
He's running cross country now and doing fine. But, I don't know what's going to happen 20 years from now. And is somebody going to say, you have a heart problem, and it's probably the result of that myocarditis that you had after you got the COVID immunization.
Yep.
Well, I worry.
Yeah, I don't blame you. The natural history of myocarditis, even though pediatricians rarely saw it pre-COVID, as a general pediatrician, I don't even think I remember a case of myocarditis. I know they happen rarely, but after COVID, it's very frequent.
Yeah. And again, a lot of it reported to the reporting system, and very little, if any, analysis has been done of any of that information. And, that was set up intentionally so that if vaccines, the immunizations of people, children and others, had some temporally related problem, the government, CDC, would all go in and investigate and see if it was related to the vaccine.
Yeah.
And in this case, they haven't touched that.
They don't even look at it. You and I remember when they pulled rotavirus for less than 50 deaths.
Yes.
And they don't do that anymore.
No, the rotavax vaccine disappeared because there were a few deaths that seemed to be related to the vaccine.
Right. So there was a system of caution back then, and that's all been overrun by some powerful interests, is all I can say.
And following somebody's science.
Yeah.
Lord knows whose science.
Yeah. Tobacco science, really.
Oh, please. That's a whole nother subject.
Let me give you the last words. Speak to parents and grandparents about COVID vaccines or whatever your final thoughts might be to them.
We have, between the two of us, presented the information that we know and know to be true about this biologic preparation. I hope that your audience will spread this information to others who may be questioning or just in the course of conversation about what's going on in the world. People need to review everything that we have said and everything that they can read carefully and ask questions carefully. I suspect that if they did that and came to their pediatrician or other health professional and asked the kinds of questions that we're urging them to ask, they may get a different story from their pediatrician or other health professional than if they failed to ask those questions. If all we've done is to give people enough information so they can ask intelligent questions, then we've done a very good thing for children and society.
Very well put, Dr. Zanga. I appreciate your being on the show and for your depth of wisdom and knowledge, and you're so articulate. Folks, ask questions. Don't stop asking questions. And if you're unsure, just pause. Don't rush into something that you don't have all the information for. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a good day, week, month, and year.
Dr. Paul, thanks for watching the show. Please visit doctorsandscience.com. There you can access our members-only section. This show is member-supported. We don't have to take sponsors. We don't have to have anybody controlling the content of our show. This is a huge perk most people aren't aware of. Your membership gives you access to my ebooks, transcripts of every show, PowerPoints from talks I'm giving around the country, and live bonus peeks at behind-the-scenes work we're doing, my off-the-cuff thoughts and reviews on current events. Your support makes all this possible. Thank you. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsandscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsandscience.com, sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.